This evening, we're going to do the entire book of Ecclesiastes, and that's really the right way to do Ecclesiastes, believe it or not. It doesn't lend itself to as well, I should say, it doesn't lend itself as well to verse-by-verse exposition, and you'll see why when we look at it. But what I would like to do is begin simply by reading the first chapter. I don't usually do that. I usually start somewhere else and then come here, lay some background out, and so on. I'm not going to do that this time, because I'll tell you why. The first chapter actually sets the tone. You get the feel for the book in that first chapter. Oh, by the way, you should have pens and pencils, because you're going to have to fill stuff in on these notes. I was informed that Matthew had spoiled you by giving you notes with everything filled in. This is not going to happen with me, and I'm going to be here for the next 5 weeks. So bring pencils. We're going to fill things in. Got to tighten it up around here. None of these freebie Bible studies. Gotta work. Okay, Ecclesiastes. Let's read the first chapter. The words of the preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem. Vanity of vanities, says the preacher. Vanity of vanities. All is vanity. What does man gain by all the toil at which he toils under the sun? A generation goes and a generation comes, but the earth remains forever. The sun rises, the sun goes down and hastens to the place where it rises again. The wind blows to the south and goes around to the north, and around goes the wind, and on its circuits the wind returns. All streams run to the sea, but the sea is not full. To the place where the streams flow, there they flow again. All things are full of weariness. A man cannot utter it. It means it's just too much to say. It's beyond words. Weariness beyond words. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, neither is the ear filled with hearing. There's always something that is not finished, see. What has been is what will be, and what has been done is what will be done, and there's nothing new under the sun. Is there a thing of which can be said, see, this is new? It's been done already in the ages before us, and there is no remembrance of former things, nor will there be any remembrance of latter things yet to be among those who come after. In other words, he's saying, been there, done that. Now, notice that it opens with this. Now, the preacher himself or teacher, and I'll tell you about that word in just a moment, he now pitches in and he says, now here's what I'm doing. He said, I, the preacher, have been king over Israel in Jerusalem, and I applied my heart to seek and to search out by wisdom all that is done under heaven. In other words, what he's saying is, I want to make sense of life. You get to a certain age in your life where just watching life happen and having a bunch of what appear to be new things to you doesn't do it anymore. You really have to make sense of some things. There is a point where you reach in your life where you really want to find out what it is about, because you start to realize as you grow up that life keeps doing the same things. It's like realizing you're in some sort of weird television show, like the old odd TV shows, Rod Serling's Twilight Zone. You remember those? And you know, about halfway through, you're going, something's wrong. You know, all of those shows, there's always something wrong. Well, what Koheleth is saying here is, the longer you're here, the more you realize something's wrong. And I want to find out what it is, and I want to make sense. But that's really where he's going with this entire book. It is an unhappy business that God has given to the children of men to be busy with. I've seen everything that is done under the sun, and behold, all is vanity and striving after wind. It's a waste of time. What is crooked cannot be made straight, and what is lacking cannot be counted. I said in my heart, I have acquired great wisdom, surpassing all who were over Jerusalem before me, and my heart has had great experience of wisdom and knowledge. And I applied my heart to know wisdom and to know madness and folly. I perceived that this also is but striving after wind, meaning the wisdom itself, is but striving after wind. For in much wisdom is much vexation. And he who increases knowledge increases sorrow. Now, before you order any Prozac, I will tell you right up front that, and you can see it, and if you've read ahead or you know anything about the book of Ecclesiastes, it's a unique book in this very dark perspective. And we're going to see, as we work our way through it, the dark perspectives that are here. Let me assure you, there is hope at the end. And you have to understand that ahead of time. Nevertheless, in order to appreciate the hope, you have to realize how dark it is. And this is why a lot of young folks don't appreciate hope, because they have not endured grief sufficient to make them lose hope. Older people tend to resonate strongly with Ecclesiastes. It tends to make a lot of sense. And it's not an accident that the author, man we will call Koheleth, possibly Solomon, says, "I've been a king a long time. I've been around." That sense of looking desperately for hope when you see that this world really doesn't offer it, this becomes the very essence of what becomes real wisdom. But it's a dark path to get there. And Ecclesiastes is really the story of that path. That's really what it is. A little background on the book. You can see your notes there. It's a wisdom book by the wisest of men, is the way I put it. The author is traditionally known as, understood to be Solomon. This was universal among the rabbis and the early Christian commentators, which would put the book at about 1000 BC. Solomon, that's roughly when Solomon was king. Koheleth is actually the Hebrew name that is used here, and it means teacher or preacher. It means a person who gathers other people together to speak to him. And that's why some of your translations will translate it teacher, some will translate it preacher, and some won't translate it. They'll leave it, the word Koheleth. Does anybody have a translation like that you're using where it says Koheleth? Okay, well, you should know the name. You should know the word Koheleth, because you see it in literature sometimes, and it's always used as a metaphor, and it's always used to point back to the author of Ecclesiastes, the teacher, the preacher. The title fits Solomon. It could have been Solomon, although recent scholarship pretty much uniformly doesn't think it was Solomon. They think it was a later person who takes on the Solomonic persona, deliberately takes on the Solomonic persona to say some things that are Solomon-like things. And remember, when people argue about authorship, it is not impinging on whether or not it's inspired. Okay, that when they say, "Well, I don't think Solomon wrote," that doesn't mean it's not inspired. It just means that they wonder about it, whether he was there. I'm going to call him Koheleth or Solomon in quotes, depending. The voice of this person is the voice of wisdom. It's a guy who's been there, done that, all over the world, got the T-shirt, nothing he has not experienced, and it's what he has to say about it. B, biblical wisdom literature is about being human and belonging to God. Now, Matthew gave you guys some good material on what wisdom literature is when you guys looked into Psalms and Proverbs. And I'm not going to reduplicate what he told you, but I do want to remind you that wisdom literature is about being really human in a real world where you've got real nitty-gritty stuff to do and you want to belong to God. And you look around at the difficulties and you're trying to make your life work. That's, chokmah is the word for wisdom, and binah is another word that's used for, it's kind of like insight. Chokmah is like skill, and binah is like insight. And these things are what you need in order to live, in order to make your life work. And so there was a vast literature in the ancient world, not just in the Bible, but a vast literature in the ancient world about how to make life work. Biblical wisdom literature is about being human and belonging to God. It's not just being human, it's being human and belonging to God and listening to what God has to say. Wisdom literature deals with the whole range of human emotions. I put that in the notes. And it issues in order to help us live well. You have to remember in wisdom literature that these are not rules. Matt probably talked about this a little bit. These are not rules that if you follow them, it always works in every way. When you look at wisdom literature, you're looking at statements that are drawn out that will work at the appropriate times in life. Because real life is not a cookie cutter. There isn't a five-step program to perfect life. Parents, are you guys parents or grandparents? You guys know, did you ever read a parenting book? Okay, the parenting books make it look actually fairly simple, don't they? Most of them. They even have charts. Can you imagine charting parenting or marriage? Well, you see, the difference between seeing a nice little chart and actually being a parent, or seeing a little diagram of how marriage is supposed to work versus being married, is the difference between simple data and wisdom. See, wisdom has to do with doing the right thing at the right time, not just knowing how things are supposed to go. It's doing the right thing at the right time. And what happens in wisdom literature is you find out that doing the right thing at the right time even doesn't always work. And this becomes very frustrating. And that's why wisdom literature was created. And that's, Ecclesiastes deals with the frustration part of it. Life just doesn't work the way it, even ancient wisdom literature kind of said it was supposed to work. So remember that wisdom literature is about doing the right thing at the right time. It's not universal rules that if you always obey this, something will always be guaranteed to happen properly for you. And we're going to see this clearly because Koheleth, who writes this, is a little frustrated with traditional wisdom literature. Number two under B, it's usually in clusters of proverbs or short discussions of practical topics. And you're going to see that in Ecclesiastes. And you'll see that he'll change. In fact, sometimes it's hard. It's like, I thought he was talking about this, and now he's talking about this, and now he's talking about this again. Is there an outline? And the answer is no. It's like a bowl of M&Ms. This is wisdom M&Ms. And you're supposed to take out a couple. If they're all one color, you can be in a, you know, it's three or four or five verses talking about one thing. Then there's another one that's kind of not related. And it's almost impossible to outline. You really can't outline the book of Ecclesiastes, although commentaries try to do it, and it's kind of comical because they're all radically different. Well, it's because wisdom literature doesn't lend itself to that. You really can't outline it. And I can tell you, tonight we're not going to eat all the M&Ms that are in this bowl. Okay, we're only going to look at some themes that are here. We're going to cover it in one night. Yet in wisdom literature, see on the notes, even in wisdom literature, Ecclesiastes is unique. And the reason is because it's very existentialist. It's postmodern and radically skeptical. It's, in a lot of ways, it resonates with our current era, in a lot of ways. Because people in our era are hopeless. A lot of people are hopeless. The reason is, well, it's a long story, but they discovered that the Enlightenment wasn't all it was cracked up to be. And what they thought was going to be a great century, the 20th century, turned out to have two of the very worst wars, well, the two worst wars in all of human history, both of them secular, not religious, and they thought they had solved everything by not being so religious. And these two secular wars just about destroyed. And so by the end of World War II, philosophers in Europe were saying, well, one in particular said, humanity is played out. Morally, it is played out. Utter, complete hopelessness. And so what you find in our culture, post-modernism said, we can organize this. We can line it up. We can make it happen. We've got technology. We've got all this knowledge. Let's make it happen. Come into the 20th century, the whole thing blows up. Then it all blows up again. They find out humans are much more evil than they thought. And now, since they've given up on God through the Enlightenment, try to do it on their own, it's not working. You end up with this wreckage philosophically in our world where people are just saying, we don't believe there is any truth. We don't believe you can agree on truth. We don't, you know, we're just going to settle for whatever works for us. And this is the condition our world is in. Well, interestingly, Ecclesiastes speaks directly to that. It's quite existentialist. And by that, I mean dark, looking at the human experience and saying, I see no hope. And it's important. It's also, by the way, I didn't put this in the notes, it's the most un-American of all the books in the Bible. And the reason I say that is because America is built on the idea that you can and should achieve happiness. You can and you should achieve happiness. Did you know that this generation right now, the millennials, they call them, people between 18 and 30, are the first generation in America that are convinced they will not be as prosperous as their parents. And it's changed their whole view of life. First generation in America to look at their future and not see as much hope in this age as their parents saw. First generation for this to happen. The American dream is that you can and should be happy if you work hard and save and vote in the right people. You will be able to make a good life for yourself, the American dream. And Ecclesiastes says, not going to happen probably. And so it's an un-American book because it doesn't hold out hope for this age. Honestly, it doesn't. It doesn't. It says basically you don't have any hope in this age. And nobody ever got elected to any public post in this country by telling people there is no hope. Even though that would be the most honest. They always build everybody up and say, we're going to get bigger, we're going to get stronger, we're going to get wealthier, we're going to be, and it doesn't work. But so it's an un-American book. I just, yeah, for what it's worth, okay? Now, Roman numeral 2, a skeptic's look. It is a skeptic's look at life's real meaning, A under Roman numeral 2. The subject is wisdom, but it arrives through the back door, through refuting simplistic views of life that traditional wisdom held. See, traditional wisdom literature said, if you do this, it'll turn out this way. And generally speaking, it all works for the, you know, you've read Proverbs and so on. And there is a general sense, and that is in the biblical wisdom literature, there's room for some give and take on it. In the pagan wisdom literature, it seemed like straight moralism. Straight moralism. Just like you, if you're good, life will be good. If you're bad, life will be bad. Does that remind you of any other book in the Bible? Did anybody who counseled a friend ever say, have a theology like that? Job's friends. That's Job's friends. See, now they lived about 1,000 years before this. If this was Solomonic, they lived probably 1,000 years before that. So you see that the wisdom literature and the tradition of be good so life will go well, this goes way, way, way back. And of course, Job is living proof that it's not always that way. Koheleth, who writes Ecclesiastes, is basically saying, you know, I don't buy it. I don't buy this just be good and everything will be fine business. Because I look around and I see lots of good people who die horrible deaths, and I see lots of bad people who are getting along really well and getting elected to office. So what gives? You know, where's the wisdom that I'm supposed to be getting? And Koheleth is skeptical. Traditional wisdom said, if you're good, good things will happen. In John 9, I'll bring you to the New Testament. John chapter 9, Jesus' friends come to him. They see a man who was born blind. Do you remember the question? Lord, who sinned, him or his parents? One of the two, that he should be born blind. You can see the theology right there. Straight moralistic theology. If you're good, it'll be good for you. And Jesus blows a hole in it. He says, neither. It's not about him. It's about God. Which is a whole nother Bible study. Koheleth is a skeptic. Number 2, finding out what works by looking at what doesn't. And as it turns out, nothing in this age actually does make total sense. I didn't give you this in the notes, but just let me remind you. According to Webster's Dictionary, a skeptic is a person who doubts the validity or authenticity of something purported to be factual. A squinting person. There was a book about Friedrich Nietzsche, who was the classic squinter at everything, if you know anything about who he was. And there's a chapter in the book called Squintingly Yours. It's a person who just, whatever you say, it's like, really? Is that really what you mean? I'm not sure. I'm not sure about you at all. So you say, well, you know, skepticism must be bad. Well, it depends on what you're skeptical of. There is a type of skepticism that's actually recommended by the Bible. Unfortunately, it's not the type that we normally hear in our culture. The type of skepticism we hear in our culture is people are squinting at God and they're skeptical of him. What God says is you ought to be skeptical about your own skepticism about me. He says you ought to be skeptical about the world's ability to fulfill your life. You ought to look around. Well, this is what Koheleth does. Koheleth looks around and he says, I'm not seeing all that much that can help me in life under the sun. And we'll see what that means in a minute. Skeptical. And God leaves room for skepticism, by the way. He leaves room in your life for doubt. In fact, he'll bring you to points. In fact, I would suggest to you that you haven't started growing as a Christian until circumstances conspire in your life in such a way that you seriously wonder whether or not God loves you and whether he knows what he's doing. And I'm real serious about that. You haven't started trusting God until he allows or brings something into your life for which you can see absolutely nothing redemptive whatsoever. Then you're trusting, you know, up until that time, he was doing what you already agreed with. Or at least he wasn't goofing it up so bad that you were going to fight him about it. Right? But you find out when he brings something or allows something that is a complete blindside and you see absolutely no virtue in it, what could possibly be good. At that point is when but that's when skepticism comes in. So skepticism is kind of the opposite side of how your faith gets sharpened. Does that make sense to you? Some people say, well, I'm not going to admit that I'm doubting. I'm not going to admit that I'm frustrated. I'm not going to admit that I'm fearful. I'm not going to admit any of that. I'm not even going to talk to God about it. What if he found out that I didn't trust him as much as I, you know? Well, then, boy, then I'd really be in trouble, and I'm already worried about that. So I'll just say, praise the Lord at everything, you know, and even though in my heart, well, see, what happens is you rot like the inside of the oak trees on my property. They look good on the outside, dead on the inside. You push them over. There is a healthy skepticism, and Ecclesiastes is all about it. It really is. Although it's quite depressing, Ecclesiastes is. Healthy skepticism. Oswald Chambers, you know Oswald Chambers. My Utmost for His Highest, one of the most famous devotional books. He wrote it. He says, doubt is not always a sign that a man is wrong. It may be a sign that he's thinking. We worry about our kids when they begin to get skeptical. I don't worry. I mean, it's serious, and it requires serious prayer, and it requires serious thought. You can't blow it off. But that means they're growing. That means they're actually growing when they ask tough questions and they wrestle with their faith. Don't despair. That's actually growth. So Koheleth is all about this. And he ends up with hope, and you'll see that. I gave you a quote there from Sanford Lasorn Hubbard. It's a standard work. Koheleth sought to use traditional tools of wisdom to refute and revise its traditional conclusions. Like Job, he protested the easy generalizations with which his fellow teachers taught their pupils to be successful. They had oversimplified life and its rules so as to mislead and frustrate their followers. See, too simple of a life where it's just always black and white and you never have any doubt and you never have any fear and you always do the right thing. There's always a right thing to do and there's always a click, 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 and this is the way it's good and you never make a mistake. It's not the way it is. Oversimplified life. And so, last sentence, so their observation seems superficial and their counsel thin in a world beset by injustice, toil, and death. Absolutely. And I got to tell you, the church could use a good solid dose of Ecclesiastes. I'm not kidding you. In fact, I have a book on pastoral care that does a whole thing on Ecclesiastes for pastors and how you got to let people go through the Ecclesiastes stuff. And you got to really go through it yourself. We need Ecclesiastes, believe it or not, because it sets us straight. Sometimes I hear Christians, do you know what the term triumphalistic means? Triumphalism in theology, and you should know the term, I would like you to know the term. Triumphalism means a Christian or a group of people who never see trauma. They only see victory about everything. It's like, you know, we're winning. Yay, look at us, you know. Look what we're doing, you know. We're winning, It is a very inadequate view of a fallen world. You get the impression these folks don't understand about sin and they haven't had actual grief yet in their lives. There are whole doctrinal positions out there in the world of religion, whole doctrinal positions that basically say every Christian should be healthy, every Christian should be wealthy, there should never be any trauma in your life. It means you're being faithless if you ever face trauma in your life. I got to tell you, Ecclesiastes is the cure for that. It really is, and it needs to be taken seriously. So Now, there are two main themes that predominate in the book, and you probably know what they are already, but this is where you get to write stuff down. A, everything in this age is vanity. Write that down. And you see he begins his work in verse 2. Vanity of vanities, says the preacher. Vanity of vanities, all is vanity. Now, he intensifies it. It's the very beginning. Emptiness. Emptiness. Vanity of vanities, all is vanity. He repeats it twice, then he adds the word one more time. All is vanity. Do you think he's making a point? And in Hebrew, when it says vanity of vanities, the way it's formed, it's an intensification. In Hebrew, if you double a word, it's the way they intensify it. He doesn't say it's very vain. They double the word. They say the word twice. And so he's intensifying it. Then he's intensifying it again. He uses the phrase twice. And then he adds the word one more time. And he also ends the book that way. Look at the end, Ecclesiastes, the end of it, chapter 12, verse 8. Vanity of vanity, says the preacher, all is vanity. So you wonder, did he make any progress? No. Basically, he starts out, his life is completely empty under the sun. We'll see what that is in just a minute. And he gets to the end, he says, yep, life is empty. He gets to the end. And then there's this epilogue, which we'll see, and there's some hope there. Vanity is the Hebrew word hebel. It means vapor, breath, nothingness. No substance. I gave you the definition. It's a term that's used 40 times in the book. I mean, it is a real major theme. And the idea is something like fog. It's not a philosophical concept. These are very concrete. The Hebrew words that are used are very concrete ideas. You know, they're not just, let's talk about philosophy here. This is about how life feels in concrete reality. What says meaningless? Your translation? Okay. Well, it's a good translation of Hebel. You can add the word meaningless to no substance. See there in your notes? In NIV. Yeah, I know. It's NIV. This is the ESV. This is the anointed one. They're translating Hebel meaningless. It's a good translation. It's perfectly legitimate. I'm going to use vanity. I'm sorry, I forgot the NIV didn't. NAS uses vanity, and so does King James, all the different Jameses. James Jr., all the various Jameses use vanity. So just those of you who do the NIV, when you see the word meaningless, just understand vanity is what it means. But the Hebrew word hebel is really what it's translating. And this word is the idea like fog that appears to be something, but then when you try and grab it, it's nothing. Let me give you the best illustration for this. Have you ever played soap bubbles with your kids where you take the little circular thing and you dip it in the bubble stuff and you blow through the bubble and they go out there. And we've done this with every one of our grandkids and we did it with our kids when they were tiny, when they're really young and they're easily impressed. Eventually they get over that, but when they're really young and easily impressed, you say, watch this, you know. And the bubbles go and they're big and you go, yeah, look at that one. And they kind of move and stuff. And what do the kids do? They reach out to touch them. All right, now, the moment that they touch it, the thing that happens is hebel. It looks real. It looks like I should touch it. It looks like it's beautiful. It looks like it ought to mean something. And then it's gone. And they look on their little faces. It's like, make some more. And they try it. They keep trying it. That's hebel. The idea is that there is no lasting substance or meaning, ultimate meaning, that you can find here. That's what it is. That's why it's NIV uses meaningless. It's what that we can possibly accomplish here. And yet, at the same time, and I don't think I gave you this, but you can write it down. At the same time, we are drawn to something that has meaning. And the wiser you are, the more you will be a seeker for anything that has meaning. You will want something that has meaning. People go after anything that claims to have meaning. They read New Age material, for instance, will tell you that there's meaning here. It's not very well supported, but nevertheless, you know, they're looking for something and they'll believe something. Why? It's because people are thirsty on the inside. There's this unfulfilled longing for reality. Has any of you guys are a mature group of people? I can tell by looking at you. So have you, do you know what I'm talking about? An unfulfilled, intense desire for reality and fulfillment that no matter what you reach for, it never quite fills the void. That's Hebel. There's a German word, Sehnsucht. You don't have to know that word, but you will hear it. Sehnsucht is this idea. It's hard to translate from German. I don't speak German, but I know this word. It's hard to translate from German. C.S. Lewis put it this way. It's like being homesick for a country you've never seen yet. And he really plays on that as meaning we've been created for something else. I mean, C.S. Lewis draws the idea of Sehnsucht out and says, the reason you long for something and you thought you'd get it when you graduated from high school, and then you thought you'd get it by going to college, then you thought you'd get it by getting married, then you thought you'd get it by having a career, and then you thought you'd get it with drugs, then you thought you'd get it with achievement, then you thought you'd get it with wealth. And at every point along the line, it leaves you emptier than before. See? Lewis pulled this out and says, the reason that that's there is because you were actually created for something much greater than what you see here. He's absolutely right. It is what the Bible teaches. And Koheleth basically focuses on this emptiness. And you say, well, why, you know, shouldn't we focus on what is fulfilling? Well, not if you really want to appreciate it. I mean, how many times have you come into an understanding of something you took for granted before because you lost it for a while? And then for whatever reason, it was replaced or something better came along. And all of a sudden you're like, oh, I totally so appreciate this. Well, see, understanding the loss increases the value of the gaining of the experience. And by the way, that's a paradigm for understanding God's plan for the universe. The new universe will be infinitely better than the best day in the old universe. And everybody in the new universe will appreciate it infinitely more than they would have had they never fallen and been redeemed. So we think, well, all tragedy is just tragedy. No, because the tragedy, if it's turned over to God, can move you out of Hebel. But you got to go through the Hebel first to get to appreciate what's coming. B on the notes. Now, see, A, everything in this age is vanity. B, because life under the sun is the phrase. It's used 27 times. And that doesn't include the times it says under heaven, but under the sun, life under the sun doesn't make sense on its own terms, which is really, and he calls it evil. I mean, Koheleth calls it evil. He says it's vanity and that's evil. He says, this is horrible. I look at this and it doesn't make sense and that's just an unutterable evil. Verse 14 of chapter 1, I've seen everything that is done under the sun. Behold, all is vanity and striving after wind. You see the phrase, under the sun. Chapter 8, go over to chapter 8, look at verses 16 and 17. This is a theme that just continues throughout. When I applied my heart to know wisdom and to see the business that is done on earth, how neither day nor night do one's eyes see sleep. Then I saw all the work of God that man cannot find out the work that is done under the sun. Man can't figure out what makes it all work. He can't figure, he doesn't see the meaning of it. However much man may toil, he says, in seeking, he will not find it out. Even though a wise man claims to know, he can't find it out. It just completely eludes him. Well, the key phrase there is life under the sun, and I gave you the definition. It refers to life in this age without reference to God or to heaven or to the next age. Although Koheleth himself did believe in God, because the beginning and the end, you know, he's the one telling the story about himself, and then there's another narrator too that speaks, but I'm not going to get into that part of it. But you can tell that ultimately, as a theistic worldview, he knows there is a God. But all the wisdom material in the middle is seen from the perspective that there is no God, which is perfect for our world, for the culture you live in right now, perfect, because that's actually what our world basically pretends there is no God. If there is ultimate meaning to life, it will not be found in this age. That's what he's ultimately saying. And I gave you 8, 16, and 17 already. We already looked at it. So now, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to trace 5 themes, Roman numeral 4, under this heading. Roman numeral 4, all efforts to make sense of life apart from God. All efforts to make sense of life apart from God are doomed to failure. All efforts to make sense of life apart from God are doomed to failure. It's the main point of the book of Ecclesiastes. And yet, it describes so much of what our culture actually does and tries to do. You live in a world that's trying to make sense of life without God all the time. What Ecclesiastes says basically is, from the dark side, looking at the dark side of everything, all efforts to make sense of life apart from God are doomed to failure. It's true. The existentialists, who were the Koheleth people except without God, Friedrich Nietzsche was one of them, Jean-Paul Sartre, you may have heard his name, Albert Camus, existentialist philosophers in the 20th century, they saw how horrible everything was, but they'd already given up on God. Sartre had been raised Roman Catholic, gave up his faith, and became an existentialist philosopher, an atheist, and then, interestingly, reconverted just before he died. A lot of people don't know that, to the chagrin and anger of all of his atheist friends, that he, including his girlfriend. He reconverted just before he died. Oops, maybe I was wrong. They basically said that the existentialist deal was, there is no right, there is no wrong, there is no God, and if there is no God, anything's permissible. Dostoevsky, anything's permissible if there is no God. Therefore, the only serious decision you have, Albert Camus, I think, is the one who said this, the only decision you have, serious decision, is when to commit suicide. I'm not kidding you. That's basically, I mean, and for them, that was perfectly consistent. And the whole euthanasia movement is based on the idea that quality of life is all that matters. Why? Because there is no other life after this. So it doesn't matter if we kill unborn infants, and it doesn't matter if we kill old people who can't take care of themselves. See how that works? It comes from this idea that, hey, what you see here, that's all there is to it. It's life under the sun, trying to make sense apart from God, make sense out of this life apart from God. When you do that, you end up with a completely hopeless life. And that's the message of Ecclesiastes. Now, 5 favorite idols are exposed in Ecclesiastes. And what basically these are is 5 themes that I picked out. They're not everything there is in the book, by any means. But they cover the themes, and we've got to do it in one night, so this is what we're going to do. We're going to trace these 5 idols. And I call them idols because an idol is whatever you live for that gives you meaning. And what we're going to see is there's 5 things in the book of Ecclesiastes that people use to give themselves meaning, and it replaces God. It makes it an idol. So remember that an idol is anything in your life that if it were lost, it could be a relationship, it could be a career, it could be even a ministry for me. Truly, I've been a minister a long time, longer than I've been anything else. And to lose, what would happen? You know, who would I be? You know, it could become an idol for me. Anything in your life that if you lost it, you'd lose your reason for living. You would really say, I'm not just sad, I think I should die. That's an idol. It's the thing that makes sense of your life. It's the thing that gives you validation. It's the thing that becomes the gravitational center for who you are. A lot of people don't even know what they are until one of them is taken away and they want to commit suicide and they realize, oh, wait a minute, that thing was the center of my life. Okay? Well, these idols that we're going to go through one at a time are in our culture right now, and every point along the line, Ecclesiastes says, that won't work. Okay, so let's have a look at them. The first one is enlightenment or wisdom. Chapter 1, verses 12 to 18, which we already read, enlightenment, that's the ability for humans to figure things out. I decided to have wisdom, and by my own mind, under the sun, without God, I'm going to figure out. And I use the term enlightenment because actually that is the enlightenment itself in Western Europe, and you're all children of the result of it. For the last 300 years, Western Europe has basically said, and America, the whole Western world has basically said, we don't need God, we don't need revelation from God, we'll figure it out on our own. Capitalize reason, human reason, the age of reason, we don't need the church, we don't need God, we don't need any of this, we're skeptical of everything. Enlightenment is the first idol that that Koheleth says will not work. Look at chapter 2, verses 12 to 17. And we're going to go back and forth on these. But just to kind of sink it home, we already looked at chapter 1. Look what he says. I turn to consider wisdom and madness and folly. For what can the man do who comes after the king? Only what has already been done. Then I saw that there is more gain in wisdom than in folly, as there is more gain in light than in darkness. Okay, so far so good. The wise person has eyes in his head. I love that phrase. That guy's got eyes in his head. I like that. The wise person has eyes in his head, but the fool walks in darkness. Yet I perceive that the same event happens to all of them. Then I said in my heart, what happens to the fool will happen to me also. Why then have I been so very wise? And I said in my heart that it will all, that also is vanity. For if the wise, for of the wise as of the fool, there is no enduring remembrance, seeing that in the days to come, all will have been long forgotten. It's so true. People so famous, you know, just one or two generations ago, three generations ago for sure, who were, they were the movers and the shakers and everybody, and they thought, man, I am really something, and you don't know their name. And nobody does today. They were just so important just not that long ago, and that's what he's saying. So how important is it for you to be important? Not very important. And yet, are we not told, don't we feel like, well, I got to make a difference. I got to be important. I got to change the world. We'll talk about changing the world here in a minute. He says, look, it's all going to be forgotten. How the wise dies just like a fool, exclamation point. So I hated life because what is done under the sun was grievous to me. It's all vanity and it's all striving after wind. What good does it do? The universe is going to be extinguished when the sun burns out. And then not only will you not be remembered, there will not be anybody to remember you. So why bother with anything? Very, very hopeless. Well, I'll quote somebody here in a minute that actually is this way. Chapter 3, verses 1 to 11. Now, I can never read this without hearing the birds singing in the background. Some of you remember the birds song, Turn, Turn, Turn. I actually brought it up on my computer on YouTube and listened to it the other day. I brought back such memories. 1965, man. If you remember the 60s, you weren't there. Listen to what he says. For everything there is a season and a time for every matter under heaven, a time to be born and a time to die, a time to plant. He uses the term time 29 times. A time to be born, a time to die, a time to plant, a time to pluck up what is planted, a time to kill, a time to heal, a time to break down, a time to build up, a time to weep, a time to laugh, a time to mourn, a time to dance, a time to cast away stones and then gather stones together, a time to embrace, a time to refrain from embracing. This was so popular among the college kids in the 60s, I think it's probably because there was a time to date and a time to break up, and it made things pretty easy. A time to seek and a time to lose, a time to keep and a time to cast away, a time to tear and a time to sow. And it sounds so, you know, like so philosophical, this poem. It is a poem. A time to keep silence, a time to speak, a time to love, a time to hate, a time for war, a time for peace. And everybody thinks, oh yeah, that's the way life is. There's a time for everything. That is not what he means. What he means is, look at this endless litany of stuff that happens and we have absolutely no control over it and we can't figure out where the meaning is in it. And you can tell because he goes on, he says, what gain has the worker from his toil? I've seen the business that God has given to the children of men to be busy with. He's made everything beautiful in its time. Also, he's put eternity into men's hearts, yet so that he cannot find out what God has done from the beginning to the end. And he's so frustrated. Life under the sun, now remember. He says, I see these patterns I can't control. All of this under the subject of enlightenment. And it's empty. The enlightenment itself doesn't solve anything, doesn't answer anything, won't give you the answers to the big questions. Human wisdom will not find it. That's why there's so much hopelessness in our world. Second idol, pleasure. Chapter 2, verses 1 to 11. Well, if we can't find meaning, let's just have a good party. I said in my heart, come now, chapter 2, verse 1, I will test you with pleasure. Enjoy yourself. But behold, this also was vanity. I said of laughter, this is madness. And of pleasure, what use is it? I searched with my heart how to cheer my body with wine. Self-medication, see? My heart still guiding me with wisdom. In other words, he knew that he was doing it on purpose to see if it would help. That's what he means. I was actually doing this on purpose as an experiment to see if it would improve my life. And how to lay hold on folly that I till I might see what was good for the children of man to do under heaven during the few days of their life. I made great works. I built houses, planted vineyards for myself, made myself gardens and parks. He was a designer. He was a builder. Planted all kinds of fruit trees, made myself pools from which to water the forest. He put in the sprinkler systems, right? I bought male and female slaves. I had slaves who were born in my house. He was breeding people, right? I had also great possessions of herds and flocks, more than any who had gone before me in Jerusalem. And I gathered for myself silver and gold, treasure of kings and provinces. I got singers. See, they didn't have CD players. If you wanted music, you needed to buy musicians and singers. Both men and women, many concubines, the delight of the children of man. So I became great and surpassed all who were before me in Jerusalem. My wisdom remained with me. Whatever my eyes desired, I did not keep from them. See this pursuit of pleasure. I kept my heart from no pleasure, for my heart found pleasure in all my toil. And this was my reward. Every time I built something, it felt pretty good there for a little while. Then I considered all that my hands had done, and the toil that I expended in doing it, and behold, it was vanity and striving after wind. And there was nothing to be gained under the sun. Man, you think, oh, I built this house. Oh, I designed this garden. Oh, I saved up this money. Oh, I did this thing. I was so wonderful. I feel so good. For what? A day or two. And then I got to do another one. Because it's always just that far out of reach. That's what he's saying. Now remember, this is under the sun, meaning these things, he was testing them to see if they would work as idols. That's what he's doing. He's saying, can I give my life to this and will it fulfill me? He says, no, absolutely not. Even the exhortations to enjoy life, and there are about four or five or six of them in Ecclesiastes. I'm not going to turn to them, although I do want to point out, because we're running out of time, but I do want to point out, you see that where it says 8, 7 to 10 on your notes? Do you see that in there? That should be 9, 7 to 10. That's a typo. Computers also are vain. Even the exhortations to enjoy life here and now, which there are several of them, are concessions. They are not statements of ultimate spiritual wisdom. Sometimes people will read Ecclesiastes as if the real goal of it is to tell you to go ahead and party. And there are several places that say, you know, you might as well do this and this and this. But in every one of them, if you'll notice, it says, because that's all you're going to get, buddy. You might as well party on. And, you know, I remember a movie I saw about World War II, where there were these young flyers in England, and they were going to fly these bombing missions over Germany, and they were partying the night before they were supposed to take off. And the older guys who were running the squadron were watching the young pilots, and they said, we should tell them to go to, you know, sleep, and because they're going into the air tomorrow. And the other guy looked at him and said, nah, half of them are going to die tomorrow. That's the way Koheleth sees, go ahead and have a party, because it's all you're going to get. In every one of these, it's a concession, and it's a sense that, well, I guess it's the best we can do. Go ahead and have a party, because you're going to die, and then it's over. Pleasure is an idol that doesn't work. Enlightenment doesn't work. Pleasure, how about wealth? Chapter 5, verse 10. He who loves money will not be satisfied with money, and he had a lot of it. He should know. Nor he who loves wealth with his income. This also is vanity. When goods increase, they increase who eat them. And what advantage has their owner but to see them with his eyes? He just sees it. I see the money come. I see the money go. Sweet is the sleep of a laborer, whether he eats little or much, but the full stomach of the rich will not let him sleep. It's an interesting proverb. He goes on, he basically says, you gather everything up and you end up giving it to a person who might be a worse fool than you. You end up leaving it for him. And he says, this is emptiness. So wealth, it's like, I put it on the notes, it's like drinking salt water for thirst. It's utterly fleeting. Wealth by itself, utterly fleeting. Fourth one, achievement. Number four, the idol of achievement or toil, the word toil. Chapter 2, verses 18 to 23. Look at chapter 2, verses 4 to 6, actually, because we already saw that. I made great works, built houses, planted vineyards for myself. You see that? And he says it's completely empty. There's, and you already read 2, oh, no, you didn't. Did you read 2, 18? Let's look at it. Oh, no, we didn't. Let's look at it. 2:18. I hated all my toil in which I toiled under the sun, seeing that I must leave it to the man who's going to come after me and who knows whether he's going to be wise or a fool. Yet he will be a master of all for which I toiled and used my wisdom under the sun. And this also is vanity. So I turned about and gave my heart up to despair over all the toil of my labors under the sun, because sometimes a person who has toiled with wisdom and knowledge and skill must leave everything to be enjoyed by someone who did not toil for it. It's an old saying among businessmen, you know, you should really work really, really hard because your wife's second husband will really appreciate it. You know, after you die, working yourself, you know. And he says, this is really evil. And what's evil about it is this. We know that somehow we were created to make something that would actually last. And we should last with it. But this world is dying. The second law of thermodynamics is in effect. And so there's this feeling of, what's the use? I know in my heart something ought to last, but nothing lasts. So the achievement, it's a waste. Who cares? Nobody on their deathbed ever says, I wish I'd made more money. Nobody on their deathbed ever says, I wish I'd been more famous. Nobody on their deathbed says, I wish I'd had a better career. Invariably, they say, I wish I'd have spent more time with my family. Invariably, if there's regrets, invariably, it's relational, because we were created to be relational, because God is relational. So achievement doesn't cut it. John Piper uses an illustration. I used it among the men. I may have used it on Sunday too, but my mind is like a sieve. It's about a guy who goes into a museum, and he goes in through the little turnstile, right? You walk in, you can't carry anything with you. You go into the museum, and he starts picking up objects of art and carrying them around in the museum. And his friends say, what in the world are you doing? And he says, I am becoming an art collector. And they said, what are you talking about? He says, look, I've got all this art. And they said, you're an idiot. You can't get out of here with that. He says, you're so depressing. I don't want to be bothered with the idea of whether or not I'm going to leave. I'm an art collector. Don't tell me about leaving. And so the moral of the story is, you know, there's no U-Haul behind the hearse. You're leaving it here, no matter what it is, no matter what it costs you. You know, you carry it around here, but you do not own it. You do not own it. You're even leaving the body you've got here. I mean, think about that. Your spirit is leaving naked. Now, as a Christian, you have a new body, but nevertheless, what he's saying, you see what he's saying? And really puts it in perspective. And then the fifth idol is justice. Look at chapter 3, verse 16. Justice. You say, well, how can justice be an idol? Justice is an unqualified good. Well, maybe. Look at verse 16 of chapter 3. Moreover, I saw under the sun that in the place of justice, even there was wickedness. And in the place of righteousness, even there was wickedness. I said in my heart, God will judge the righteous and the wicked, for there is a time for every matter and for every work. I said in my heart that with regard to the children of man, that God is testing them, that they may see that they themselves are but beasts. Oh my, that's depressing. What about all the justice stuff in the world? What about it? We got to make utopia. We got to fix society. We got to change the world. We got to make it better. And the answer is, why bother? And that's exactly, if there is no God and there is nothing after this, why? Has anybody thought that through? Because a lot of people believe that they're just big grown-up germs and that the universe is going to end with a big explosion. And if long before it ends, you're going to end anyway and go back into nothing. So whence comes all this desire for justice? Who cares? Who cares if you die at the age of 5 or the age of 50 or the age of 100? Who cares? You're going to die anyway. And you're smaller than a blip on the radar screen of eternity. And so are all the people around you. You know, when people figure that out, when they really figure that out, that atheism and the whole world under the sun doesn't give them a meaning for justice, then they say, well, then I'm just going to take what I want. Because if this is all there is, who cares? The will to power, that's Friedrich Nietzsche as well. The will to power, just take what you need. Because you only got this. I wrote it in there for you. Note, our secular world assumes that we must wipe out poverty, injustice, war, and prejudice. I mean, you hear this all the time. And I agree 100%, but what bothers me is our world doesn't have a reason for it. They say they're going to do this, but their feet philosophically firmly planted in midair. There's absolutely no reason philosophically within a naturalistic worldview or even a spiritistic worldview why justice is important, only if there's a God. Which means people intuit that there's a God, and they act as if there's a God, and they believe justice is right, and they're right, but they've sawed off the branch that they're trying to sit on, philosophically. So I put in the middle of the paragraph, why? Why bother with justice? If there is no God, and life is all and only about this age, and we cease to exist when we die, what's the purpose for human justice or altruism? Only if there's a God does justice make sense. Always remember that. Always remember that. That's why Immanuel Kant, who was something of a theist, but he's the archetypical Enlightenment philosopher, the most famous Enlightenment philosopher is Immanuel Kant. And he basically is the guy who said, that's how you can remember his name. He said, you can't understand anything about God because it's beyond your 5 senses. So Kant said, you can't. Always remember that. But then he realized if everybody actually believes what I'm telling them, then they're going to go crazy. So he wrote another work in which he said, however, for the sake of morality, you have to actually assume there's a God. And he went on to describe, essentially, a God who knows everything, a God who's perfectly moral, a God who will judge people after this age. It's called Kant's moral argument for the existence of God, and it's quite compelling. He wasn't sure there was a God, but he was sure of this. If you don't believe in God, you will have no reason to be just and fair and loving and kind or anything. He knew that. So after he destroyed our ability, supposedly, our ability to know anything about God, he then turned around and said, but you have to pretend God is there. Did you know that? But you don't have to pretend because God really is there. I had more, but I will move on. B, there's one ultimate truth revealed in Ecclesiastes. So we see the 5 idols, now the one ultimate truth, chapter 12. Remember also your Creator in the days of your youth, before the evil days come and the years draw near, which you say I have no pleasure in them, which for those guys was about 35 in the ancient world. Although some people lived quite a bit longer, but the hardworking classes, if you hit the age of 40, you were up there. Before the sun and the light. And the moon and the stars are dark and the clouds return after the rain in the day when the keepers of the house tremble. Now he's describing a body getting older. The keepers of the house tremble, the strong men are bent, the grinders cease teeth because they are few. Those who look through the windows are dimmed and the doors on the street are shut, meaning you can't hear. When the sound of the grinding is low and one rises up at the sound of a bird. So you're going deaf, but any little noise will wake you up. And all the daughters of song are brought low. They are afraid of what is high and the terrors on the way. And the almond tree blossoms and the grasshopper drags itself along. That's a reference to impotence, actually. And the desire fails because a man is going to his eternal home. And the mourners go about the streets before the silver cord is snapped and the golden bowl is broken and the pitcher is shattered at the fountain or the wheel broken at the cistern and the dust returns to the earth as it was and the spirit returns to God who gave it. Vanity of vanity, says the preacher. All is vanity. So he ends his speech with death, and his one thing to say is, if you're young enough and if you've got any wisdom at all, you seek the Creator now. Because if you wait, you're going to waste a lot of time. Besides being wise, verse 9, the preacher also taught the people knowledge, weighing and studying and arranging many proverbs with great care. The preacher sought to find words of delight, and uprightly he wrote words of truth. And the words of the wise are like goads and like nails firmly fixed are the collected sayings. They are given by one shepherd. My son, beware of anything beyond these, of making many books there is no end. And much study is a weariness of the flesh. This was an actual life verse for those of us who were in college back at Biola University. We would quote this constantly. Verse 13, the end of the matter, all has been heard. Fear God and keep his commandments, for this is the whole duty of man. For God will bring every deed into judgment with every secret thing, whether good or evil. So he ends by saying, basically, the whole thing is meaningless. The only thing that matters is God and God's word. Number one under B, only God and his word ultimately matter. That's the bottom line. Only God and his word ultimately matter. So verses 1 to 8, start fearing the Lord as early as possible. And verses 9 to 14, wisdom is good, but God will judge everybody. Only God and his word ultimately matter. Number 2 is a question for you to write down. First of all, do you agree only God and his word ultimately matter? Now, let's pull our heads out of the depression here for a moment and say, do I agree with that? Only God and his word ultimately matter? All those in favor, say aye. All right, I agree too. However, write this down. Is this good news? ? Is this good news? Only God and his word matter. Fear God and keep his commandments. For this is the whole duty of man, and God will bring every deed into judgment and every secret thing, whether good or bad. Paul said, when the Lord comes back, he's going to judge all the secrets, the kryptos. That's where we get our word crypt. Your brain is a crypt. It has many skeletons in the closet. They're all going to be judged. And I ask you again, is this good news? Some of you are wondering, well, and we haven't gotten there yet. I'm staying in the Old Testament. See, what you got to see here is this, you know, we all go, oh, yeah, as if we're keeping the commandments of God. As if we go, oh, that's easy. Oh, yeah, I'll keep all the commandments of God. He can judge all my thoughts and all my words and all my deeds. Why? Because I've been so good. Really? What I want to point out here is this isn't such good news. We read it because you read the end of the book. See, we read the truth of Christ into here. But you know, the Old Testament actually ends with a big question mark. How is it going to turn out? It's like a telescope where the eyepiece is missing. The gospel of Christ is the eyepiece that makes the entire telescope work. So actually, I'm going to submit to you that this is not good news at the end. If you take it just, if you say, well, okay, then it's straight legalism. I will obey God's commandments, and to the extent that I've been obedient, then I'll be saved. Now, how many people are saved by keeping the law? None. So it's not as good a news as it might look, because the law actually condemns. Yet it's completely true, and you were right to raise your hand. It's completely true. So where's the hope? It's in Christ, of course. You see that last outline? Turn to Matthew 19:28. What did Jesus look forward to? What did Jesus Christ look forward to? I'll tell you what he looked forward to. The next age that he was purchasing with his own blood, Matthew 19:28. They said, "We lost everything here, Lord." Oh, I wish we had time. We're running out of time here. Verse 27, Peter said in Matthew 19:27, Peter said, "Look, we left everything and followed you. Is that okay? What are we going to have?" Jesus said, "Listen, I'm telling you, in the new world," that's the word palingenesia, the regeneration of the universe, "in the new world, when the Son of Man will sit on its glorious throne, you who have followed me will also sit on 12 thrones, judge the 12 tribes of Israel. And everyone who has left house or brothers," or by the way, the 12 tribes of Israel and the 12 apostles, it's the 12 apostles that actually become more important than the 12 tribes of Israel. Do you see that's what he's saying? That's because his covenant is better than the old covenant. You see, that's what he's saying. All right, then he says, "Everyone who has left houses or brothers or sisters or father or mother or children or lands for my sake will receive 100-fold and will inherit eternal life." But a lot of people who think they're going to be there won't be there. That's what verse 30 means. What did Jesus look forward to? A, not much in this age. I wrote it for you. But then write this. Yet he lived in profound and healing hope. He had this profound hope. And this is how you're supposed to live. But not for this age, you see. Did he look forward to much in this age? No, not really. Yet he lived in profound and healing hope. And he healed everywhere. He was radically committed to bringing healing, shalom, blessing here. Why? Write this down. Because his focus was on the new world, the regeneration. He lived in profound and healing hope. Number one, fill in, because his focus was the new world and the regeneration. That's what he teaches us to look forward to. That's where the hope is. It's not in this age. It's not under the sun. But you'd have no access to it if it weren't for him. He's the one who gives you access to this hope. He and he alone, which is why he says, whatever you lose when you belong to me, it doesn't matter. You can't get it out of the museum anyway. You might think you're an art collector, but you're not taking it with you. And I have art for you already in this other reality. This is Jesus. Paul clarifies this in Romans 8:18. Turn over there. Because this is the only veiled reference in the New Testament to the book of Ecclesiastes. You know how a lot of books in the Old Testament are quoted in the New Testament? Ecclesiastes is not quoted in the New Testament. But it is alluded to here in Romans 8, and I want to show you where. Verse 18. I consider that the sufferings, Romans 8:18, I consider that the sufferings of this present time are not worthy to be compared with the glory that is to be revealed to us. You see the Ecclesiastes feeling there, the sufferings? For the creation waits in eager longing, sehnsucht, for the revealing of the sons of God. For the creation was subjected to, what's that word? Futility is the one in my anointed translation. It's the exact same word that's used in the Septuagint version of the Old Testament in the book of Ecclesiastes 40 times. There's no question Paul is actually thinking of Koheleth here. He's saying the world is futile. But let me tell you, he says the glory that's coming is so great that it isn't even to be compared. Don't even worry about it. It's so much better. It'll make you forget any evil and make anything worthwhile in this age. That's what he's saying. It's a huge claim. He elaborates on it. I won't go any further. Listen, if the hope that you've got your life centered on won't go past the grave, it's not worth it. The only hope worth it is the gospel. So be under your notes, on your notes there under five, Jesus is the true and greater Koheleth. Jesus is the true and greater Koheleth. He's the real teacher. He's the real preacher, the true and greater Koheleth. And then I wrote the rest for you. He experienced the ultimate futility, emptiness, and vanity on the cross. He's the one who said, my God, why have you forsaken me? Not only that, all his friends and family had forsaken him. The entire world had forsaken him. I mean, he is Koheleth. I mean, you talk about the person who understands the hopelessness. He experienced the ultimate futility, emptiness, vanity on the cross so that we could have ultimate fulfillment. That's exactly why he did it. He joined the justice of God with the mercy of God at the cross so that we could be forgiven and given credit for following all God's commands. Now the last verse of Ecclesiastes is good news. Why? Because you can keep the commands? No, because Jesus kept the commands. It gives you credit for it. That's what the gospel is. He forgives you based on what he did, but also the goodness of his life is given to you so that it's on your account. So the Lord looks at you, and that last verse of Ecclesiastes is you. And when the judgment happens, you really do get the reward because of what Jesus did. Number three, he gathers a people. Remember, the Koheleth is the person who gathers the people and talks to them. He gathers a people that will receive credit for walking with God in the darkness of this age, keeping his commands and receiving his righteousness. He says, these are my people, Matthew 16, I will build my church. These will be my people. I'm going to purchase them. I'm going to take care of them. They will suffer in this age just like me, just like literally everybody else, but they have this whole new life coming. And that's the only thing that gives hope. It's the only thing that gives hope. And then you can actually enjoy whatever there is to enjoy here. Because it's not the end. How can you enjoy it if you know you're going to get killed the next day? But if you know you're going to live forever, then you can actually enjoy the good that you have in this age. Do you see that? See how that works? So the gospel is the only message of eternal hope in this world. The only message of eternal hope in this world, see on the notes. The only message of eternal hope in this world, and Ecclesiastes points directly to it by contrast. It points directly to Christ, the true Koheleth. So Ecclesiastes basically turns down the lights here so that we can see the next age. And for that, it's wonderful news. I'm going to close with, and you don't have to turn to it, I'm going to read it to you. I'm going to close with a passage from the New Testament, Colossians chapter 3, verses 1 to 4. And then we're done. If then you have been raised with Christ, seek the things that are above where Christ is, seated at the right hand of God. Set your minds on the things that are above. In other words, not under the sun, but above. Set your mind on the things that are above, not on the things that are on the earth. For you have died, and your life is hidden with Christ in God. And when Christ, who is your life, appears, you also will appear with him in glory. Amen. Father, we pray that you'd give us the wisdom of Koheleth, both the hopelessness in this world, and we do thank you, Lord, for reminding us of how hopeless the world is. There are so many things that have caved in on us in this age. And every time something else caves in, it just reminds us of the glory that you have in store. So help us not to let our hearts be set on the things of this age and to live redemptively in this age, enjoying what you have given us, but having no idols here, Lord. Thank you for Koheleth. Thank you for Ecclesiastes. Thank you for the bad news that points us directly to the good news. In Jesus' name, amen. God bless you. You're dismissed.